You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and for Dear Science, this week we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Hi, Caster. How are we?
We're good. We've got lots of science today, which is always a good start to the show.
I can't disagree with you there. Mm-hmm.
And it's as I said earlier, a little bit, we've got some falsehoods.
We do.
We've got some stories about falsehoods. Why are people lying about what they're eating?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And how are we getting to that question, I guess? Mm. And so to answer that, I'd ask another question is, you know, what foods are good for you, what foods are bad for you, and how do we know? And basically, this comes as a result. This knowledge comes as a result of many years of looking at what people eat and then trying to correlate what people eat with, you know, any sort of adverse health outcomes that come later in life,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And so the way that we do this, or the way that, not we, but the way that food scientists and nutritionists and co do this is generally they rely on questionnaires. And so they will, you know, send out questionnaires to people and they will ask them to monitor what they've eaten and drunk over, say, a week or a month or something like that. And then they gather all of those results together and they analyze them and they try and figure out any correlations with sort of adverse health effects and stuff like that. So basically they are relying on people to correctly say what they have eaten or drunk over.
So we can have reliable results, you know.
You absolutely have to, okay? So, you know, and if people aren't self-reporting correctly, then we have problems.
Yeah, some pretty bad outcomes for any validity of these studies, I'd imagine.
Yeah. So if we're relying on people reporting correctly, then how do we know that they're reporting correctly? So that's a big question. And so this has been addressed by a recent paper in the journal called Nature Food, which is one of the Nature stable of journals. And this is a paper which has got, I didn't count, but it'd be probably close to 100, I'd say, authors.
Wow.
From all around the world, excluding New Zealand. Couldn't see any Kiwis on there.
Well, maybe we'll get there next time.
And basically the take-home message from this is that people generally underreport their food intake. That's what they've figured out. Now, how have they managed to do this? So what they've done is they've used a thing called the doubly labelled water technique.
Ooh,
I know.
What's a doubly labelled water?
What is a doubly labelled water? Okay, so water is H2O. That's the one chemical formula that everybody on the planet knows. You walk down the street, you ask anybody, what's the chemical formula of water? They'll say H2O, okay? What we can do with water is that we can replace a hydrogen with a heavier version of hydrogen called deuterium, which is absolutely harmless, but it can be distinguished from hydrogen. And we can also replace the oxygen with a heavier version of oxygen called O18 rather than O16.
And does this look like water still?
It is. It's absolutely indistinguishable from the real thing.
Worrisome. Maybe I've consumed some on accident.
No. But it's all okay because they put this in with your foods and stuff like that to basically figure out your energy consumption, because what happens is that the oxygen in water ends up in the carbon dioxide that we expel as a result of burning things, essentially, in the body and getting energy from that.
Right.
Okay. So if we put in a certain amount of the specially labeled water and then we analyze it when it comes out, we'd expect less oxygen, less of this heavy oxygen in it when it comes out as wheeze or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Because of the fact that we're losing the CO2. Now, the hydrogen, the special heavy version of hydrogen, doesn't get metabolized at all, and so that just basically comes straight out. So you're using that ratio
we can track
of the heavy hydrogen to the heavy oxygen,
right,
and they then say, right, we can use that ratio to figure out essentially the energy consumption of people, okay? And So that's what they do. They analyze the urine of participants for this. They figure out what that ratio is, and then they can figure out, so, the energy consumption.
Right.
Now, what they then do is they take these data, which are fairly extensive, that they have developed, and they can then derive an equation for the average daily energy expenditure of your average person, okay? Yep. And then they utilize this. Then they go back to all of these sort of dietary questionnaires that people have filled out over squillions and squillions of years, okay? And they're comparing this sort of average daily what should be versus what has been reported, okay? And their initial finding was that basically 50% of the reported intakes were on the low side. So people, so basically 50% of people were underreporting what they had eaten and drunk over a particular time period, which, you know, that is significant. And they found differences with different sort of food groups. So people who ate a lot of protein, for example, would underreport more than, I don't know, vegetarians or something like that.
Interesting.
Okay? Right, so this paper immediately ran into controversy.
Yeah, I can imagine, right?
Because there are a lot of nutritionists and food scientists and stuff that don't believe this doubly labeled water technique actually does what it says on the bottle, so to speak. So there's a bit of controversy about that they've the original authors have to get this believed before anyone's going to take them seriously. But really embarrassingly, the paper was published, I think about a month or so ago, and already a correction to it has appeared.
Ooh.
Which is never good.
No, that doesn't sound like something we're aiming
for. And the
for.
Authors had actually made quite a substantial mistake in their calculations. And instead of using megajoules, they're using kilojoules.
Well, that does sound like a sizable mistake, yeah.
Well, it's a factor of 1,000, basically, straight away. And so did this affect the results? Yes, it did, absolutely. Mm. But they're still saying that what they're seeing is a real effect. So they've gone from the saying that 50% of people underreport. Mm. Now, using these corrected figures in the corrected paper, they're now saying it's 27% underreporting.
It's still a lot, yeah.
And it is. And, you know, the ramifications of this are quite substantial. Mm. You know, if we're going to be making scientific pronouncements on the basis of incorrect data, then, you know, that can never be good. And so I'm sure there are methods for validating these questionnaires, but basically these people are saying, no, you know, whatever methods are using to validate these things are not being effective, and we're still getting 27% of people underreporting. Yeah. So what the heck do we do about this?
Yeah. And very worrying that 27% feels like they have to underreport as well.
And, well, I guess, you know, I've done my partner many years ago used to be a nutritionist, so I've been involved in a couple of these sort of things. And you know, keeping track of what you eat for a week is actually bloody tough because this is sort of in the days before everyone had a phone and stuff like that. So you kind of had to write everything down. And you're having a mid-afternoon snack or something like that. Yeah. And very often you'd forget and then you'd try and do it the next day and try and remember what you ate and everything. So it's very understandable that people can, you know, mistakenly, you know, misreport what they've eaten. But in terms of this whole underreporting thing, you know, it's not an overreporting thing, it's an underreporting thing. And you know, it's a very, very interesting question and one that will certainly probably be on the radar of the nutritionists and food scientists for a wee while yet, I think, as a result of this. Yeah,
Next year we've got fluoridated water. Yeah, what are we doing with this fluoridated water? Dear, new findings?
Well, what's Bobby Kennedy doing with this fluoridated water?
Right.
That's, you know, Bobby Jr.
That's,
you know,
our question, right.
And he's a ginnet. He doesn't like it. And he is going to tell the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in the States, he's going to tell it to stop recommending it. Now, he himself can't ban it. He hasn't got that power. Thank goodness. But he can certainly have a word to the Center for Disease Control, which is, you know, not great. Utah has banned it, okay?
Yeah.
And so the question then becomes, well, look, do we have any data for places who used to fluoridate and now don't fluoridate.
And now don't, right.
And can we make a comparison? You know, are there any data? And it just so happens that there are. Okay.
Perfect.
So two decent-sized cities, Calgary in Canada and Juneau in Alaska in the States. Mm. Okay. And Calgary and Juneau both used to fluoridate their water supply. Calgary stopped in 2011 and Juneau stopped in 2007.
Sizable data sets there.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, obviously, the thing to do is to, do a before and after comparison.
Yeah.
So, what these people did is they studied the dental health of second grade students. So, so they're probably age six, I guess, six, seven, something like that, in Calgary and in Edmonton. Okay. So, both, you know, comparable sort of Canadian cities, one of which doesn't fluoridate, one of which does. And they did this 7 years after the fluoridation stopped in Calgary. So this was 2018.
Full life.
Okay. And so in that case, that meant that these kids had never been exposed to fluoride in the water. Okay. And so there was 2,649 students. So it's a decent sample size living in Calgary and Edmonton. What they found was that 65% of the students in Calgary had tooth decay, as opposed to 55% in Edmonton, okay? Mm. Might not sound like a lot, but that's statistically very significant.
Yeah.
You know, that's a whopper.
It's shocking to me that 55 in Edmonton have tooth decay.
Yes, exactly.
Well.
Yeah, exactly.
They seem like very high amounts of...
You know, that's our good old sugary food diet and everything and stuff. Yeah. That's the way that it works. So... what they also... So they did an update on this, so in 2024 and last year. So they did a study and they found 32 per 10,000 children in Calgary required some sort of dental procedure that required general anaesthesia.
Mm.
So that's a fairly serious thing. Yeah. And the comparative number in Edmonton was 17 per 10,000.
Yeah, so almost double.
So again, So again, that's, you know, that's massive.
Mm.
So, you know, we're seeing effects here. And in Juneau, so they looked at the average number of procedures in children under the age of six to treat tooth decay. And in 2006, that was 1.5 procedures per child. And in 2012, it was 2.5.
Mm. Big increase there.
So again, another big increase.
Yeah.
So, look, there are your numbers, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You know, do with them what you will. And as a result of part of these numbers, so Calgary has reinstated fluoridation, but Juneau hasn't.
That's good news.
And Kennedy is making these pronouncements on the basis of a recent meta-analysis that supposedly shows that fluoride leads to a lower IQ. The fluoride levels in that meta-analysis were far, 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 far greater than what was put in, what is put in town waters all around the world. And also a lot of the data came from, let's say, non-reputable sources.
Right.
And the phone's probably lighting up even to say that. So we might run on to the next one, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And then next we've got this Sodom Comet. What's even going on here?
Well,
I don't know where to start.
Do you know the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah?
That does sound like a reasonable place to start. I'm familiar.
Okay. So we obviously know what went on in Sodom. I've still to find out what went on in Gomorrah.
Right.
But, so supposedly Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by God, supposedly.
Yes.
Okay, so the big old fireball and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Lot's wife was told not to look back, and she looked back and got turned into a pillar of salt and, you know.
Something along those lines.
Generally not good. So there are people who want to find evidence for this.
Mm.
And so one person has supposedly found evidence for this that he published about 2 or 3 years ago in a journal called Scientific Reports, where he said that there was evidence of high temperature melted pottery and melted surficial sediment in a place, in a little town, called Tel El Hammam, which is in the Jordan Valley near the Dead Sea.
Right.
Okay. Excuse me. So he published a paper on this about 3 or so years ago, and he's comparing it to this thing called Tunguska, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but this was in 1908 in Siberia, and this is massive unexplained explosion that we still don't know what caused it. It might have been a comet, it might have been antimatter, we're not sure, but it just happened in this extremely remote part of Siberia and wasn't sort of discovered for a while later, but just absolutely flattened the place. So he's sort of saying a similar sort of thing happened here, and is sort of using as evidence of, you know, God and stuff like that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, not wanting any controversial here. But basically the paper has just been withdrawn from the journal in which it was published. So basically the argument is that this high temperature thing that he's seeing, this melted pottery and everything, that was just ancient smelting techniques. It can easily be explained by that. So Occam's razor applies. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. And it, so it wasn't a fireball from space. And just to sort of cap it, there's also evidence of image manipulation, which seems to be the big thing these days. Putting things into Photoshop and then sort of playing around with them and making them look like you want them to look. So we're still awaiting scientific confirmation of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is what he was saying, that this place, this Tel El Hammam, probably was. And just to absolutely cap it off, if you look him up, he describes himself as an independent researcher.
Right.
Which is always a red flag. If you're not associated with any sort of academic or whatever institution or government institution, something like that, it's just red flags for me anyway. So I think we can lay that one quite safely to bed. So.
Yeah. Big news for scientific discovery. We're solving things. We're putting things, I guess, to be solved in the future, and we've been making big scientific bounds that will continue in the world of science, as they always do.
That's true. Science is inexorable.
Yeah, we're left with always on Dear Science new discoveries that we should look forward to in the future.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for coming in, Alan, and sharing these scientific stories with us. As always, thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.